Big Adventures with Brian Durker is brought to you by Humphrey Summit Ski. Humphrey Summit Ski has been supplying Flagstaff and the surrounding area with quality ski and snowboard equipment for the last 40 years. They offer service, repairs, boot fitting, and more, all from the friendliest staff in Arizona. On the corner of Beaver and Elm and in Grand Canyon Spirits on Humphrey Street in Flagstaff.
This is Brian Durker with Big Adventures. Welcome. Hey, sit back and get a load of Carolyn Alvord. She's an interesting story. I think I am learning more about horse racing than I ever thought I'd be able to. And just an interesting story. Carolyn's been a boatman in Grand Canyon for a really long time, but her story is much, much deeper. And, you know, all of us have watched a horse race here and there. Let's get deeper into the underworld or underpinnings of what it's like to be a jockey. Also, the rest of the story is fantastic. So I welcome Carolyn to this show, and I look forward to asking all those questions we've always wanted to ask about horse racing. So settle in and enjoy. You know, the first thing I always like to ask is where you come from. I mean, where were you born?
I was born in Connecticut, East New Haven, Connecticut.
Uh-huh.
And moved to Long Island when I was six.
Oh, wow. Long Island.
Yep. Grew up on Long Island.
And so did you go to high school on Long Island?
Yep. Went to high school. And
what's it like? What are the high schools like on Long Island? I mean, it's what kind of a setting was it? What kind of house you live in there?
It was suburban. It was Stony Brook, and it was, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, so it wasn't really well developed. The university wasn't there yet. So it was pretty rural, I would say.
Oh, wow.
It was far away from the city, out on the western or north part of the island.
And so you lived there clear through high school? And
right through high school, and then moved up to New England at 19.
And what did your folks do? What brought them to Long Island?
My dad was a vice president of an insurance company in Manhattan, and my mom was a permanent substitute, so she substituted every day.
Substitute taught was it grade school level or high school?
High school.
Were you a good student?
No.
Did you have any sports involved?
All sports. Yeah,
did
all
you?
Sports, yeah.
Tell us about that.
Oh, I was good in sports. So I was on every team they had. Basketball, soccer, field hockey, gymnastics, track.
Oh, wow. Let's go back to you were there till you were 19.
Right.
And then you went where?
Then I moved to New England. I rode the hunters and jumpers at a farm close to our house from the time I was probably 10, maybe 10, until I graduated high school at 18. And I wanted to work with horses, so I tried to get a job. But I was only 18, but I had done a lot on the farm that I worked at, and it was hard to get a job instructing when you're only 18 years old. Most of the time, they just want you to work in the barns. So we used to vacation up in New England, and I never liked New York just because it was getting more crowded. As I got older, it was getting more populated, and the university went in, and they put in a riding program, and I taught the Sunny at Stony Brook University. I taught their riding program. But then when I tried to go out and go on my own, I was young. I was 18, turning 19. And so I moved up to New England where we had vacationed. I always wanted to live up in New Hampshire. So I moved up there and tried to get a job, had trouble instructing. So I went to the racetrack.
Oh, so that early you went to the racetrack. Now, had you had experience with horses before you were 18? You were involved.
Hunters and jumpers.
Hunters and jumpers. And
right.
How would you go about that? Did your family have horses?
No. I just, ever since I was little, kindergarten, I always wanted to ride on the red spring horse. That's every day I go into school. That's what I wanted to ride. It was just, she's like, there's plenty of toys. Pick another one. I was like, nobody signed up. I want that one. So I was just determined, and I wanted to ride that horse every day. But I was always into horses, and none of my family is, except for me.
But so when you're young and you want to ride horses, how would you get access to them?
Well, we went vacation up in New England, and my dad, because I was such an avid pain.
Your dad helped you.
Well, everybody had a ride. My parents both. Everybody had to take lessons. We had to take family lessons, so it was five kids and my parents, so seven of us taking riding lessons. We took them once a week on vacation. Then it was twice a week. Then three times. Then four times. And my brothers and sisters were getting annoyed because I was the only one that really loved it. But my dad knew I had a passion, so he kept us all riding. And finally, he was like, all right, she gets her own lessons, and everybody can stop.
Oh, cool. Well, good for him. So you've got that many brothers. And what are they all doing now?
They're all insurance, just like my dad was.
They're all into it.
Right, except my one sister. I have two sisters and two brothers. One sister worked. She was a shipping manager for, like, Estee Lauder, one of those places in New Jersey. But my two brothers are in insurance, and my other sister's in insurance.
Oh, wow. And so they're still back there.
Yeah.
You've got lots of family back there.
Yeah, I have one brother in Florida, my sister, one sister in Louisiana, and a brother and a sister in New Jersey.
Oh, so they're in New Jersey now.
Yeah.
Now, when you started instructing, talk to us a little bit about what that entails. Would you take somebody that was completely green on a horse, or would most of the people that you're instructing have some background with
them? Nope. Most of them were pretty much green, especially when we got the university. Sonny at Stony Brook came over. They had to take either gym or horseback riding, and they thought that horseback riding was easier than taking a gym class. So they came to the farm.
And how do you start on that? Do you walk them in a circle and get them comfortable on the back of the horse?
Yeah, and you have a whole class. So you've got like 12 to 15 people, you know, college students on horses that have never been on horses before. And they're in a ring.
Yeah.
So they're in an enclosed ring. But you start them just walking and trotting and bouncing and kind of falling off a little bit.
Uh-huh. And would you be the only instructor?
Yep. Yes, I was.
Stony Brook, it's still a pretty well-known school, really,
right.
Isn't it? But they had just built it. It was kind of a new school.
It was, yeah. When we moved there, it was just woods. And then I think it was built when I was in high school. So we moved out to Stony Brook when I was in fifth grade. So I was 11. And I don't think the university came in until I was like 15 or 16.
Oh, so that's kind of, you got your feet on the ground on the ground floor. And,
right.
So you say you went over to the racetrack. What would you do to get access to those horses? Would you just go watch them run and then you hung out in the stalls?
It was the backside. So you need a license to get in the back area, not in the grandstand area. And it was brand new for women to be what they call on the backside. Women weren't allowed on the backside until I think it was the late 60s that they were allowed to come in the backside where the horses are kept. It was all male, set up for men. All the bathrooms were just for men. The kitchen, there was no separate places for women. So it was different than the grandstand. So I went back there and just asked if they needed some help. I wanted to exercise horses, but like everything else, they were like, well, you're awful young. And so you can groom the horses and take care of them, but, you know, we're not sure about exercising yet.
And so you kind of worked your way from the ground floor with the race. And where was this? It was in?
At Suffolk Downs in Massachusetts.
Oh, Suffolk.
Right, so right outside of Boston.
And, of course, there was all kinds of maintenance on the stables and all that stuff. You probably got...
Right. We don't do the buildings. The buildings belong to the racetrack, but you have your assigned horses. And we had seven horses, so I had to take care of seven horses. So I groomed them, took care of their legs, fed them. You know, so I was there from 5:30 in the morning till 6 at night.
And so are those seven horses held by a single owner, and you work for an owner, or you work for the stables, or you work?
You work for the trainer. So
the trainer.
The trainer trains the horses, and he can have a variety of owners. He might own some himself. The first fellow I worked for had almost all, he had six himself, and he had one that he was partners with somebody with. But trainers can have their own horses, or they can have a mix.
And then you go along, and you finally get to where you can get on the horse or whatever. How long did that take?
I got there in October or November, and it gets pretty cold in New England. So around January, the exercise riders stopped coming out when it was snowing or if it was below zero. So they'd stop coming out. And so the trainer said, "You said you could ride, didn't you?" And I said, "Yes." And our exercise boy hadn't shown up for 2 days. And the horses need to go out every day because they're racing. So they need to exercise. So he says, "Well, do you want to get on one?" And I was like, "You bet.
Sign me up."
Yep. And so that was
the,
it.
The great opportunities of attrition.
Right? Yep. Somebody didn't show up. So as soon as I got on one and it was a good trip, then I started getting on all of them. And then the exercise boy came back 2 days later and the trainer was like, "Oh, I have a few for you, but she's doing a great job. So she's going to get on the horses now."
What would a daily routine for a racehorse be? I've already taken care of it, and then you get on its back. What sort of program do you have as far as exercise?
You just listen to whatever the trainer wants. Uh-huh. The trainer will tell you how far to go and what he wants the horse to look like. So if he wants you collecting the horse, getting the horse so he's on the bit or pulling on the reins, you're kind of chirping to him and getting him on his toes, getting him so he wants to run, which they love to run anyway, so that's not the hard part. It's keeping them under control. Uh-huh. That's the hard part. So he'll tell you how fast he wants you to go. And sometimes they'll say you want to do a 2-minute clip. So that means the racetrack is a mile long. He wants you to go around at a 2-minute clip. So you should be able to do one circuit in 2 minutes.
So they do a 2-minute mile.
Right. And that's an easy gallop.
Uh-huh.
And then some mornings there's workouts where he's timing you for a quarter mile or a half mile or 3/8 of a mile. And he'll tell you where to start and where to stop.
And probably the better you got, the more that they had you doing the latter part of that exercise schedule.
Oh, yeah. As long as you can stay up there and don't fall off very much, which, you know, I didn't have a problem with that. And if I fell off, I usually get right back on. So that wasn't bad. But
does that kind of transcribe into actually becoming a jockey and being in races? What's that transition from?
Well, it's usually because once you start exercising horses and then you might go out and the trainer might team you up with another person so that you have your horses going head and head. So there's a little competition. But not only is there competition with the horses, but there's competition with the riders.
With the riders. Huh?
And you feel it. And there's an adrenaline thing going on. So you're, even though you're exercising in the morning, you still want to win. I mean, just some people just have that drive.
Right.
You just want to. So the more you do it, the more you want to ride. The problem is jockeys are small. So you need to be able to do the weight because the horse is assigned the weight and you have to do whatever the horse is assigned with. And a usual common weight for a horse is 112, 115. So that means you have to weigh that with all your fully dressed with your boots, your helmet, your saddle, your girths, all your weight has to be 115 pounds.
And so if you're not that, they add weight to you?
No, if you're not that, if you're underweight, like a lot of jockeys are, say, 4'11 or 5 foot, and they only weigh 100 to 105 pounds, and if with their saddle and everything, they only weighed 110 pounds totally dressed, then they have little sleeves in your saddle that you can put a lead piece of lead in.
Oh, I had no idea.
They'll put lead in there. So the reason that you get weighed before and after the race is because if you're carrying lead, you have to step on the scale with your saddle with the lead in the pockets. And then in the race, the jockeys used to throw the lead out of the pockets so that lighten the weight for the horse. So then they started weighing the jockeys before the race and after the race to make sure that they didn't get rid of their weight limit.
And if you don't mind my ask, what size were you when you were doing this?
When I rode in races, I weighed 105. My natural weight.
And how tall are you?
5'4".
So that's your natural weight for racing was about 105.
Yeah,
so
hard diet.
You were tiny.
Oh, I had a diet. My natural weight's 120, 125, always was.
Is it a disadvantage to be taller?
Yes. Well, because you can't eat. You can't eat and you can't drink.
Right.
So
you'd have to kind of cram to get to weight before races?
Well,
or like...
yeah, I was on a strict diet. I was on Fit for Life, so I ate no meat, no dairy. I ate a little bit of fish, lots of salads, vegetables.
Bring us through your very first race.
Very first.
Can you go back to that? I mean, what kind of a race was it? Was it a...
yeah, it was a race... I was on a horse called Brown Brass, number 7. And so I was in the 7 hole So horses can be up to 12, and there's more in the Kentucky Derby, but there's 12 in a regular race, so I was number 7. And since there weren't very many girl jockeys, my husband at the time was just saying, stay clear of everybody. They didn't want me to ride. They didn't want me to get a license because another thing, a girl breaking into a male-dominated field.
Yeah, it must have been quite an element, yeah.
Right. He's like, just mind your business. Don't, if they curse at you, don't curse back. Don't look at them. Don't hit, don't wave your, don't even cock your stick. So you have a whip, and they didn't even want me to twirl it to show it to the horse or anything. He said, like, don't, stay out of trouble. Just stay out of trouble. Stay away from everybody and go wide, which is usually you try to get to the rail to save some time.
Distance, yeah.
Yeah, and distance. And he said, just stay wide. And he put the horse, was a horse that we owned ourselves, and he was a router, so he would go a mile or more. So he put him in a race for 6 furlongs because that was not the horse's style. He always came from the back. And he said, this way you won't be in the mess. He'll be out of the race and you won't be close to anybody. So I said, fine. So I he said, break in the 7 hole and stay in the 7 hole all the way around, which means I'd be wide around the turn, which they usually call blowing the turn because you're losing a lot of
distance. You're gaining, adding distance.
Right,
to your,
exactly. So I stayed there, and as we were coming around the turn after about a half mile, I could feel the horse kicking into gear, and I was way on the outside. And I still hadn't touched him with my stick. And we were coming down, and I started passing all these horses. And I was like, we're going to
do this.
We're going to be real close. So so we got there right at the end and at the wire, and we were head and head with a horse. And it was probably a 3-minute, 4-minute photo finish. So they couldn't decide. The judges have to decide who won the race. But the other fellow was a seasoned jockey, Tommy Santos. And he looked over when we crossed the wire and he said, not this time, honey. And so he knew he won it. But the judges took a long time because they have that wire and they have all the cameras with the stop action. And
yeah,
they finally decided.
So you were right in the hunt. You got second place.
And I got second place, and the horse went off at 25 to 1. So for coming in second place, he paid like $27 in the middle. So if you bet $2, you got 27. And the jockeys wanted to not give me a license because they said I should have won the race. They complained and they brought it up to the stewards and they said she should have won that race and we don't want her to get a license.
But explain that. She should have won the race. Why wouldn't she get a license?
Well, because the jockeys have to approve you. And they have to approve you. They have there's a guild and they have to approve you. And they didn't want to approve me because they said I should have won. And the stewards were like, well, she was 27 to 1. This horse never runs 6 furlongs. And they were like, yeah, but she never cocked her stick. If she would have hit the horse, she would have won the race.
So they felt like you were inadequate for the...
Yes. And I had been exercising horses. That was a long time. I had been exercising horses from the time I was 19 when I went to the racetrack. And I started riding after I had my third child. So I was 32. So I had been riding every day from 19
really?
To 32 before I started. So I had a lot of experience and worked 7 days a week. And I used to get on 18 horses a day. So I got on a lot of horses. So I had a lot of experience. And the stewards just looked at the jockeys and they said, this girl did nothing wrong. She was on a long shot and she just got beat. And they're like, well, if you approve her, we're not going to okay jockeys in the race anymore. And the steward said, we're going to approve her. So then they stopped having the jockeys give the okay to the riders. And the stewards did it from then on.
Oh, interesting. And you could see how that would be a conflict of interest anyway, the jockeys that are trying to protect their jobs. And you've got some hot pistol that happens to be a female coming into it. They feared you.
Yeah.
And then things started sailing. You did a lot of racing then?
Well, I rode pretty much just for my husband. So he had a big stable. It was Rigatieri Racing Stable. And we had between 20 and 40 thoroughbreds on the racetrack. So he was a big trainer. And trainers claim horses out of races. So a lot of times it's almost like a conflict of interests. A lot of trainers didn't want to ride me because my husband was a trainer. And if I... They call it fingering a horse. If I liked a horse that somebody else had, I could tell my husband, that's a really good horse. You should claim that. claiming races is when the horse goes in and you can buy the horse out of the race.
Oh, I see. Conflict there.
Right. So they didn't want to ride me because my husband was always one of the top five trainers and he claimed most of the horses on the, you know, out of different races. So it was hard for me to ride anybody else's. So I really only rode for my husband. Very few other people I rode outside of our stable.
So then how do they schedule? How do you get scheduled into races? Like, I've always been kind of fascinated. I've stood there and watched them get in the gates and, you know, just the local races that used to be here around here.
Right.
How does that work? Is there some sort of a draw you have as far as where you start? And
yes.
Explain a little bit. Like, if you're going into a race, you are paired up with a horse.
So the trainer asks you if you'll ride his horse. So he comes over and asks you if you're free, if you can ride this race on this day. And you've probably been exercising that horse for the trainer, unless you're really good and get what they call a hot rider, and then they just call you. But the horse gets his position by pills, so they have a shaking bag, and then the horses are drawn out, so they draw out the numbers. So that's kind of like a lottery, which number your horse gets. And that's how you get the position.
And so they give that horse that number, and that position in the starting gate goes along with that.
Right.
And then what kind of type of scrutiny would the horses go through? As far as a pre-race, and, you know, you always hear about doping, and what kind of a scene was that in the background there, previous race? Like, say, the Kentucky Derby, you always hear about these scandals to where there's a trace amount of an...
Right. They don't want you. There's certain drugs that you can't give a horse for a race, and it's just like the Olympics when they're, you know, testing the people for drugs. There's certain drugs that you can't use. Butazolton is one that is legal, but, you know, you need to use the correct amount of it, which is an anti-inflammatory painkiller.
Uh-huh.
But then there's other ones, stimulants. So we didn't use those, but other people did. And if you get caught with them, you can get ruled off or get the purse. The money can get taken away. Your horse, if it wins and it gets, you always have to go to what they call the spit box. So they take a urine test of the horse to see if there's any drugs in the horse. And if there is, they'll take the purse away. Plus, they'll fine the trainer. And they'll also usually give him a suspension of a certain amount of days, depending on what it is and how bad it was.
And were you ever around that at all, where there's scandalous result from the spit box?
No, I never had that. And I never had anybody approach me to what they call hold a horse. So a lot of times gamblers or other people would come up to a rider and offer them money not to let their horse, if it was the favorite, to hold it back so that they could bet on other horses.
And so, did you ever have anybody approach you?
Nope.
Never?
No.
You got out of there with a clean scene, huh?
Yeah, because I only rode for my husband. I wasn't a outside rider that rode for a lot of different trainers. And I was never a hot jockey, so I never had, like, I wasn't like one of the top 10 where you're getting a lot. I had a lot of mounts because we had a lot of horses, so I rode a lot of races because we had a lot of horses in every day.
And did your stable have a lot of other riders?
Not a lot, maybe two. Usually try to ride one in particular. And then I didn't want to ride all the horses because we had a lot of owners. And some owners don't like girl riders just the same. And I didn't want to be a hindrance. It was my thing. I was the one that wanted to ride. And my husband said, you know, well, you paid your dues. You might as well ride if that's what you want to do. But I didn't want to hurt his business. Because he was always one of the leading trainers. So if the owner liked me, which most of them did because we were good friends with most of the owners, they wanted me to ride their horses. But some of them didn't. And you don't fit every horse. It's just like everything else.
Yeah, I was wondering about that, if there's these subtle little things that go along with a horse-to-rider sort of relationship.
Yeah, and sometimes you can pick up on a horse and get their little idiosyncrasies, and sometimes you can't. Some people fit horses better, and some people just have a knack for getting the horse to do what they're asking.
You have to do the deal. Now, you were married. When were you married?
I got married in 76, so I was 22.
Uh-huh.
It was great. I mean, he trained horses. I rode them. I didn't really like the training part. You know, he'd tell me what to do. I loved riding. So I rode as a, you know, kid in hunters and jumpers. I won the Junior Olympics in jumping when I was 17 in New York.
Oh, wow.
And so I just loved riding. I didn't really want the training part. I just like being on top of them. So, you know, made a good pair, and we worked together for over 20 years, you know, just on the racetrack. And
so let's talk a little bit about Hunters and Jumpers. I mean, this is great stuff for the listener. I mean, a lot of us watch horse races at a distance, and we don't know, you know, the insides of this, so it's kind of fascinating. But let's talk about Hunters and Jumpers. I mean, it always amazes me. I've been around a little. My sister-in-law was into endurance and all that stuff. But jumping a horse, what's that all about?
Oh, that's good. It's fun. It's kind of like flying almost. You like it as long as you make it over. And what happened was I used to go to the farm every day. I didn't have a lot of money. My parents didn't have a lot of money. We had five kids. So I used to go there every day and I'd work. I'd brush the horses, tack up the horses, feed the horses, and then they'd let me ride a horse. So any new horses that came in, that was my job. I'd get on the new horses. I'd teach them how to jump. I'd take them to their first hunts. I'd take them to their first shows, and they'd pay my entry fees because I didn't have the money to do any of that, but they'd pay it. So I'd give the horse experience, and then they'd let that horse go out to other people that were taking lessons there, and they would rent the horse for the day at the horse show or take them to the hunt. So I would break the horse in. And I break all the babies. They used to breed some of their horses there. And I'd break the babies for riding. And got me riding. And I didn't have to, we didn't have the money to pay for my riding. So I'd work so I could ride.
And so, like, when you're, what's the highest stuff you would jump? Like, when you were in a competition or something, what kind of dimensions are we talking about when you're jumping a horse?
Probably between 5 and 6 feet.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, between 5 and 6 when the Junior Olympics was 5 and 6. And they're all different shapes, and they try to make them look different. So,
yeah,
they, you know, stone
that
walls
the
and
different
oxers and cans and big barrels and chimes. They try to make them look, you know, so it would be not real comfortable for a horse, but you're trying to get this horse to go over these things and have confidence in you. And some of them are timed. The class that I was in was a fault now, so you couldn't knock anything down. And after you made your first two passes clean and knocked nothing down, they would time you. And then the fastest time, that's how I won the Junior Olympics, was I had the fastest
time. And where was that held, the Junior Olympics?
That was on Long Island.
Oh, okay.
That was on Long Island.
Well, that's pretty cool. You won the whole deal, huh?
Yeah. I was the last. I didn't even know it. I was the last rider in the jump-off. And everybody was screaming. I'm like, why are they screaming? And my dad was there, and he goes, that's it, you're it, that's it, you won. So I was the last one. I didn't even realize. You're just all pumped up when it.
Well, and focused on, yeah, on the task at hand and stuff.
Right.
How many jumps will be in a circle?
It's not a circle.
Well, you go back and forth.
Right, there's a pattern.
I've watched the Olympic stuff.
Right, and so there's a pattern. So it can be anywhere between, I'd say, 7 and 12.
Different jumps.
Yes. And each time, like in a jump off, they might take a few off. The first one is usually has the most jumps. Then they might cut it down, raise the fences up, cut it down, take a few out, make the course a little harder, make the turns a little sharper. And
so you kind of had to pay attention to where you were going as well.
Exactly, because they changed the course. It wasn't always the same course. And the time that I won it, I made an error on my last fence, and I turned the horse, and as I turned, I hadn't watched, and I turned her right into the fence, and I'm like, oh, that's it, we're out, and she jumped from a dead standstill and made it over. I don't know how. And that's why I was not paying attention at all, and when she did that, because we were right there, we cut off all those extra seconds, and that's how I won.
Oh, wow.
And because she didn't knock it down or anything, but I got what they call left, like I was way up in the air holding the end of the buckle on the reins, like out, totally out of control. And she made it over and I stayed on. And that was
Did
that.
You have any wrecks jumping fences? Falter or stop? You see this thing where the jockey goes over the head?
That's happened a lot. But I've never done it in jumping. I never in competition never did it. But I've gone through a lot of fences or horses misstep where they don't jump. They just go through the fence, and usually you're part of that mess.
Did you get any injuries ever?
Yeah. But I rode a lot of horses for a lot of years. But most of my injuries, I had fractured my skull riding on the farm, hitting a tree. That was probably my worst accident because I was in the hospital for a long time. But just fractured my skull. on that one. But then race riding is more dangerous and fell off more because the horse trips or they get caught up in their bandage or they fall coming out of the gate or they flip over in the gate. So more injuries on the racehorses than I did in the jumping horses.
Well, one time I was at just a local race and I was standing. I really liked watching them load the gates. You know, mm-hmm. I was standing behind the starting gate, which is kind of a wild process in its own right. And the last horse was bucking around in there and it threw the jockey backwards. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all the other horses are in the gate and stuff. So he only had microseconds to kind of get on when the gates open. And I was just blown away. It was an older jockey.
Yeah.
And somehow he, right as the horse is blowing out of this gate, got himself sorted out and foot in the stirrup and off they went. I was really impressed with the athleticism I saw there.
Yeah, they're good athletes. And that's the most dangerous part of the whole race is in the gate because the horse is confined in that metal gate and you're in there with him, which is not much bigger than the horse, and it's all metal. So anything he does, if he rears up or smashes you on the side, it's padded a little bit, but still, their horses are almost 1,000 pounds, sometimes a little over 1,000 pounds. So when they flip up or hit you or pin you between the gate and them, it could be
a serious deal.
Yeah.
So walk us through getting into the gate at the start of a race, because I've noticed there's a walk around and then the horses are kind of meandering around there, and then these guys come out and bring them to the load.
Right. They all put them in order. They have to go in order. So you have a man that leads you in the gate and he walks you in and then jumps up in between and he'll exit through the back. So once you walk in, the front of the gate is closed.
Right.
The back is open. So they walk you in. Some horses need a little prodding to get in there because they know what's going on. They've been schooled in the gate. You do that when they're 2-year-olds. You take them in and out the gate, all the way through the gate so they're comfortable. And they break out of the gate on a regular basis. They have to get an okay, just like a rider has to get an okay so that they can go in a race and they feel they're safe enough to be out there with other riders and other horses. So they have to get an okay. And in a race, they line you up and each person has a gate man on their head and the gate man walks in, the front is closed, he jumps up on the sides and then out the back, they shut the back gates. And then the horse knows that gate's going to open pretty soon. So they're kind of on their toes and they're leaning towards the front. They know it's going to, sometimes, and sometimes they'll pop it. Sometimes they'll hit that gate and it'll pop open. And just his gate will open. Then they have to hopefully catch the horse if the rider isn't off. Sometimes that horse is scratched and can't run because they can't catch him. But sometimes they can get him back and he has to.
So they don't get disqualified if they false start.
No. No, but they have to go back and.
It's a pain in the ass. And then people are all loaded up in the.
Right.
Now, what's it like? Like, say, if you're one of the early lanes or the early starts,
like 1, 2, or 3. Yeah,
that must be a little nervous.
It is,
while
you
got to
wait for everybody
horses.
Else. Yep, it's terrible.
It's terrible.
The more noise they make, the more your horse starts dancing around, and you're trying to keep the horse calm. And sometimes they need a man there to hold the rein on that one horse that you're on. But you have to be careful because when that gate springs, when they spring it open, you don't want that guy holding your horse by the bit. Because that's going to hold him back. So you want to make sure he's got a light hand, but he's got to have a strong enough hand to try to calm the horse down.
Yeah, and so that just real soon after that last horse is loaded up, they pop that thing.
Well, the starter, he has a little microphone on, and he's talking to you in the gate, and they have microphones in there. So the jockeys, they'll be saying, if their horse is bad or taking a bad step or rearing up, they'll say, no boss, no boss, like don't ring the bell. Don't open the gate. No boss, no boss. And once that starter sees everybody looks quiet for a second, he's gonna ring that bell.
He's gonna pop it.
Yep.
And that's exciting stuff right there alone, the start. And so like when you're further into your racing career and stuff like that, it's none of this wide track around there. You're having to get in the mix of things and get your good line and stuff.
Yep.
What's that like? I mean, when you got horses all around you and stuff, that must be exciting.
It is. And you're getting hit with dirt, you know, so you have goggles on. You usually have like at least three goggles on. If it's muddy, you might have five pair of goggles stacked up and with like Saran wrap in between them. And then once one gets muddy, you'd flip it down. So you might have a stack of five on. So you have to be careful not to run out of goggles because there's no way to get the mud off. You can't, you'll smear it and then you can't see. So you have to flip it down. So you might have a stack of five goggles on and flipping them down one at a time if you're not in front. If you're in front, you're good. You're not getting hit with mud. Otherwise, you get hit straight in the face with mud.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I've noticed that a lot of these guys have all kinds of stuff going on with their goggles. And you see these muddy races where everybody's just smeared.
And it hurts. That. It's like somebody taking dirt. It's like a horse kicking mud right in your eye. It hurts.
I bet it
And you
does,
just got to look straight ahead. There's nothing you can do. You got to look where you're going.
And what about the other equipment? Are the helmets pretty substantial? Do you have to have a... I'm sure you would go to great lengths to have a good tight-fitting helmet.
Yeah, the helmets are good, and you have to have a flak jacket. That came in, I don't know when that came in, maybe in the 80s or the early 90s, you had to wear a flak jacket to protect your ribs, because when you go down, there's a good chance that you're going to get stepped on or just hitting the ground when you're going 20, 30 miles an hour. It's easy to break ribs.
Oh, yeah.
So they started making that mandatory to wear a flak jacket. Exercising in the morning and racing in the afternoon, you have to wear that.
Yeah, it sounds like a smart enough piece of equipment for you. And then, like, when you're in a race and you kind of watch everybody kind of scrambling, it's crazy, and then they settle into the run.
Right.
Talk a little bit about how you inspire that horse to run, or how you find your lane, or how you deal with crowds.
Well, you're just looking. You're looking on both sides of you and in front of you, because you're in control of the one horse that you're on. And you can do what they call clipping heels. So if you have a horse directly in front of you and you're pushing your horse too fast, his front feet are going to step on the horse in front of him's back feet. And that's called clipping heels. And usually both horses go down. Because it's a misstep. They're not hitting the ground. So usually both will go down and then both riders go down.
Uh-huh.
So you have to be careful of that. Or if you're going to switch lanes, you have to make sure you're not cutting somebody off or cutting somebody short, because if you get caught doing that, because there's cameras all around the track, you can have your number taken down. So if you win the race and they say, well, yeah, but when you went to make your move, you cut off the horse that finished third. Now you have to go behind that horse. So actually you won the race, but we're going to place you fourth because you're going to be behind the horse that you cut off.
That's how that works.
And that's what the stewards do.
Yeah, because I have watched races to where there's this apparent winner, but then there's this stall and everybody's wandering around waiting, and people who bat are all uptight.
Right, and the stewards are looking at the films to see whose fault it was and if there was an increment that shouldn't have happened.
Now, who are these guys, the stewards? Are they just professional horse people that are on a certain...
Yeah, they're like judges. Like they have the judges at the Olympics, the same thing. So they sit up and they have a booth that they sit up in that they can see the whole racetrack, and they have cameras and TVs up there so they can see different angles. And then if they need to, if they have to make a disqualification or see if there was a foul that was occurred, they have to... put it in slow motion. They can look at it. So that might be the weight that you have after the race to see if that horse impeded somebody else or the jockey made a bad move and cut somebody off or came in to get to the rail and cut somebody off that way to get, cut them off so they almost clipped heels with another horse. You have to, it's like driving a car. You have to have enough room. Otherwise you can have your number taken down.
And some jockeys were probably known for being a little more aggressive and dirty than others. And and you would know who those guys are.
They're just trying to win a race. It's not that they're bad people.
But it's just their
aggressive style
of aggression.
Yeah, and they're aggressive. Yeah.
Now, the rest of, like, surrounding a race, how would the other jockeys treat each other in the back there when you're getting ready for a race or when the horses are in stall?
Usually they're good friends. They're separate rooms. There's a jock's room for the girls and a jock's room for the boys. So you don't mingle. You don't mix. So when I was riding, there were only a few girls riding. There might have been three in the jock's room. Where in the boys' jock's room, they might have had 20.
Yeah.
So it was much larger. They had a pool table, a ping pong table. We had nothing. All we had was a set of bunk beds. They had a kitchen, a like a bar there where they, you know, could order whatever they wanted to eat. We'd order what we wanted to eat. They'd cook it in the jock, in the men's jock.
Yeah, they just
bring it over.
They weren't too old for the female rider.
Not at all. They now, maybe now they are. I'm sure they are now, but they weren't then.
Well, hopefully they are now. But as you rode and as you carried on with that career, were there more and more women coming into it?
There were more and more women, and usually women don't stay in the profession as long as men. They get married or have kids or something, so they're moving on. Or they it was hard. I only rode for about a year and a half competitively in races because I had so much trouble keeping my weight down, and I used to have to sit in the what they call the sweat box to sweat off 2 or 3 pounds every day. So you'd have to sit in their sweat box, you know, at 100 and something degrees for 2 or 3 hours every day.
Kind of like wrestlers. I remember the high school wrestlers would run around in rubber suits and not eat and make themselves puke and you name it.
Yeah, couldn't drink water or eat until after the races when you're heavy.
That's nuts. That must have been semi difficult.
Yeah. Well, it was difficult, but you know, otherwise you could do Lasix or do pills or, you know, they do flipping, which is they just eat something and then bring it right back up.
Bounce it up.
Yep. And
flipping.
That's what they call flipping. And but they get good at it. I mean, they can take peanut M&Ms and swallow them and put them right back in their hand. They can swallow them, they get good. It's really bad for you and bad for your teeth, but they, you know, they're used to doing it. You know, I never wanted to do that, so I dieted really hard, which is a hard lifestyle.
Like you said, you had a round-the-clock diet.
Yeah.
And so how did you wean yourself of the energy and the adrenaline rush of competitive racing? Did you stay in the horse business?
Oh, yeah. And I went back to exercising horses. I only rode for a year and a half, but I realized I wasn't as good as some of the jockeys, what they call when they get hot. So if you're a hot rider, you're going to win a lot of races. So I won 63 races, which was good because I only rode really for one trainer in a year and a half and didn't do a lot of outside riding, but I rode a lot more than that. So your chances of winning are maybe, I don't know, 1 in 20. So, you know, you're riding 60. If you win 60-something races, you're still hundreds, you're riding hundreds of horses in races to get to 63. So so that was
Explain the different races. I mean, you've got longer and shorter distances and explain that a little
bit. It's just like people. Some people are sprinters, some are cross-country runners, some like to go longer, some like to run on the dirt, some like to run on turf, which is grass. So, and some horses like it a dry track, and some horses like what they call a muddy or a sloppy track. So horses are like people, and certain horses have different shape and different size feet, and their feet do better on certain turfs or either grass or dirt. Some horses don't like getting hit with dirt or don't like getting hit with mud. So they're usually better turfers. They run better on the grass, except you get big clots of grass thrown at you. But it doesn't hurt quite as much as the dirt.
Did you have a preference of surface
when
you were running?
I liked a fast track, a dry track, as compared to muddy, only because they trip more in the mud. But if you have a horse that likes the mud, they can handle the mud, that's good. But not all horses can. And you don't know what the weather's going to be until the day of the race. So you might be on a horse that hates the mud and trips all the time. You know, when it gets muddy, it gets heavy.
So that leaves you a little nervous going in. And then what about turf? How do they even keep a turf track?
Well, the turf, you can't exercise on it. It's only used for races. So that's usually on the inside. You have your dirt track, and the turf course is usually on the inside of that. So they don't use that for exercising, so horses don't get
beat it up.
Right, exactly.
Yeah,
it gets
a
lot more maintenance.
Field
right, and they don't run too many turf races to keep it in good shape so it stays, you know, they have to water it and everything else. So.
Well, that's fantastic, getting, you know, the jockey's point of view of riding those horses, because it looks like an extremely dangerous business.
It might be dangerous. I don't think you think of that. I mean, I never thought of it when I was riding. I just wanted to ride.
Yeah. And it just must be thrilling.
Oh, it is.
Full stride.
Oh, yeah.
Those horses are going full cob, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so when you're in the stirrups, how do you adjust your ride? Do jockeys have different riding positions. You know, the stirrups are way cinched up, and you're right. in a squatting position.
But right.
Explain the saddle is
really small. The yeah. saddle. I had two saddles. I had a small saddle that weighed a pound. That's so 1 pound.
Really, 1 pound.
1 pound, and that's with the stirrups. So the stirrups are metal, and you have two girths. You have an undergirth that hooks from saddle to saddle, and one goes all the way around. So you have an undergirth and an overgirth. So you have your saddle, your stirrups, and your two girths, and it weighed 1 pound.
That's incredible.
Right. And
I had no idea.
It was like nothing. It was like sitting on a pad. It was, and you don't really sit when you're in a race. You're not on the horse's
back.
Yeah,
you're on your legs.
Right, right. You're crouched.
And then what sort of headpiece or what sort of a bit and all that goes along with that? Are there
that's up to the trainer. A lot of different kind of bits that they have depending on the horse and how he is to handle. And some horses have a problem. They might have a bad leg, or they just have a bad habit of getting to the outside. They want to go to the outside. So sometimes they'll have with blinkers, which cover parts of the eye. They have like an extension blinker that would be go farther on the outside, so he can't see to that side. So they drift less in that direction.
Less because they don't want to go where they can't see.
Right. They have different kind of bits, stronger. Some they have run-out bits that have little prongs in there that would stop him. You know, he'd feel the prongs as you pull on your left rein because he's leaning to the right and the prongs would come out. And they're squared. They're blunt prongs, but they're still prongs. So he would move away from that and move to the inside. But there's a lot of different kind of bits and different equipment that you can put on horses to try to help them stay in a straight line and help the jockey control them.
Now, is all that included with the saddle as far as your weight?
No, the bridle is not. Just your saddle, just what you're going to sit on or have your feet stirrups on. So my one saddle was 1 pound. My big saddle was 5 pounds. And that felt like a regular riding saddle, even though somebody that was a English rider would say that's tiny. But to me, it was big because it was way bigger than my 1 pound.
Yeah, I mean, 1 pound, you could hardly, I can't even imagine.
No.
And that includes your cinches and everything.
Yeah, and your stirrups.
And so then you kept doing the horse business and kept training and all that. And then where did life take you after that?
Well, then I went out to visit. My one brother had moved to California for an insurance job and was moving back east. He had been out in California for about 3 or 4 years and was moving back east. So he wanted me to come out with my kids. I had 3 kids at the time, and they were 7, 10, and 12. And he wanted us to come visit because he was moving back east and I'd probably never get out west again. My whole family's from the East Coast. Nobody's out west. So I planned a trip to go out there. My kids were 7, 10, and 12. And we just headed out there. My husband didn't want to go. He hated to fly. He said, you take the kids and go. And I wanted to go to a dude ranch. And he said, no dude ranch, too many guys. So do something else. So I was looking at Kids Sports Illustrated magazine. And they had rafting in the Grand Canyon. We're all athletic. I said, oh, well, we'll go rafting in the Grand Canyon then while I'm visiting my brother. And that's what I did, and that's how I ended up here.
And so tell me about your first rafting trip in the Grand Canyon.
So that was in 1992, and the kids were 7, 10, and 12, and we flew out. We were going to go to the Grand Canyon, drive around, go into Mexico, and then drive up the coast of California to my brother's. So the rafting trip was in April. We went in April. I went with Canyoneers, and it was a one-boat trip, and it was a great trip.
And so that started it all off, and you loved it.
I loved it.
Did the kids love it, too?
Yes, best vacation, and they're now in their 40s. And still to this day, it's their best vacation they've had, and they've been on a lot of vacations.
Oh, that is totally cool.
Yeah.
And then, so how did, I know you worked for Canyoneers after that, but how did that go from your first trip as a client? Explain the progression there.
Well, I had the 3 kids with me, so I was setting up camp for 3 kids and myself and helping unload the boat, and then I'd go help with dinner, and I'd help prep the food, and then if they did a hike or a hike after dinner, I went on the hike. And lucky for me, there was a couple on the trip. They were 2 lawyers, and they couldn't have kids, and they wanted to watch my kids terribly. So anytime there was a hike, they were like, leave the kids with us. We'll play with them in the water right here by the boat. The other guides are staying. Go on the hike with Chris. So that's what happened. I ended up hiking a lot. They would watch my kids if they didn't want to go on the longer hikes.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. And it was perfect. They loved the two people and the couple loved watching the kids. And so I did a lot of hiking and still helping with all the stuff on the boats and went on all the hikes. And Chris Peterson was the one. He let me drive.
That got his attention. Yeah. The help.
Yeah. And then he let me drive 217. My first trip. And,
wow.
Yeah, which was awesome for me.
And you didn't hit either shoreline. And
no, I stayed on
that. You made it through 217.
Yep, made it through. And he was like, hey, lady, you need to do this. I was like, sure, okay, whatever. We have a big farm. We had a big farm at the time up in New Hampshire, 40 acres and 40 horses. And there was a racetrack on the farm with a starting gate. So we had everything, you know, I was all set up. So I could bring the kids up on the farm, not the racetrack. And I went back in 93 with one of the kids, the oldest one, Nicholas, and then the next year with two of them. And they kept asking me at Canyoneers, please come work for us. We'll pay you, don't pay us. And they kept saying it. And they said, didn't you say they live right next door? I said, yes. Well, wouldn't they watch the kids for a little while in the summer when they're off? And I was like,
really made the play on you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And Joy kept calling and asking. And finally, I asked my mother if she'd watch the kids. And she said, sure. You know, they never have a babysitter. You're always home on the farm. She said, I'd love to watch them. I said, well, how long would you like to watch them for? They want me to stay, you know, for a couple of weeks. And she said, well, they're off for 8 weeks. Why don't you go for 8 weeks?
That made it easy.
Yeah.
And now, Joyce Daveley, a member of this community for a long, long time. She has just passed.
Yeah.
And give her a shout out there for that. I mean, it's as we go, we lose our older community members and stuff like that. Yep. So shout out to Gaylord and, you know, golly. Yep.
But I stayed there for 18 years. I worked for them for 18 years. So that was good. And they were, Joy was a big promoter of female guides. And so,
well, she was a very active voice in whatever she was believing in, let's put it that way.
Right.
And so that doesn't surprise me that she'd be an advocate.
And she wanted me to be a trip leader. I was the first trip leader for Canyoneers as a woman. And so that was hard breaking into that also, just getting to drive the boat. I didn't have a lot of people.
A lot of support on that mission?
Very little, right. But we got there.
And so 18 years of working for Canyoneers, and that's a pretty darn good stretch for a single company and stuff like that. And then you came to work for me.
I know.
And that we had some great trips together.
Yeah. I only had 2 days off before you asked me to go to work for you.
Well, I remember, you know, just like those guys that were saying, you got to come to work for me. I remember what you were going through at that time, and we had a lot going on back then.
Yeah.
With the scientific work.
Yeah, it was awesome.
Yeah. No, that was
great.
Good jump from one place to
the
other.
It was, because I was afraid to move from commercial to science, you know, just because it was a whole different deal. I'd see them on the river, but I never really knew what they did. They're fishing or they're doing, you know, sediment work or something. But once I did it, and working for you was great because it opened me up to a whole new world down there.
Well, yeah, you jumped in both feet. And you're still doing that. You're doing the Razorback Sucker work. Talk to everybody a little bit about the work you're doing now.
Yeah, so the Razorback Sucker is a native fish in the Colorado, and they're just trying to get a handle on the population and where they're moving or how far up the Colorado. They used to be native to the whole river system. But since the dam went in, they kind of flushed out to the lake. So they know they're down in Lake Mead, but they weren't quite sure how far up or if they were still. They thought that they were totally extinct from the Colorado River. But the more they looked at it and they started working their way up from Pierce Ferry, they were finding more and more larval species of the Razorback Sucker and kept moving up. And now they're all the way up to the Phantom Ranch by the Silver Bridge is our first stop. And they might even be up higher than that, but they don't have a permit to study higher than that.
So they're monitoring. Explain how they're monitoring. They go X amount of distance and sample and.
Right. So there's 56 sites from the Phantom Ranch down to Pierce Ferry, 56 sites, and it was all computer generated. So we started out with 100 and something sites. Some of the sites, since they didn't want any interference by humans looking, saying, oh, that would be a good place for fish, they had a computer do it. And some of the spots you couldn't get a boat into, or some of them were too surgy, or there was no place to seine. So what they do is they're taking seining nets, which is like a screen, and they're about 6 feet long, and they go along the shore, and they pick up any of the larval, which are very small. They have to look at those through a microscope to see what species they are. Or they get another group takes seine and checks for juveniles, which are larger than that. And they can identify them by eye. So the 56 sites, we stop at each one. We have one group going out studying and checking for the larval samples, and one group studying for the juvenile. And they do that from March right through September.
Yeah. No, it's been a really neat project to have kind of call your own.
Right.
It seems like you found a really nice spot.
Niche. Though. Yeah, it's really good.
And, you know, for the listener, there's been so much work done on the humpback chub, and there's a couple other species that were, like the razorback sucker, thought to be extinct, and they're trying to do some transplants into tributaries and
right.
this, that, and the other. But pretty interesting work, and the native fishes are just beautiful fish
yeah.
in the first place.
And, yeah, and they're starting to, the humpback chub are really taken off. I mean, when we first were doing these like 5 or 6 years ago, and we said we caught a humpback chub down by Pierce Ferry, they're like, no, they're not down there. But we had taken a picture and we had tagged them with one of the tags. So we knew, and we had pictures of it. So they were like, I can't believe it's down there, you know. So it was pretty interesting.
Well, it's remarkable. You know, I did a lot of that work for 30 years.
Right.
I was involved. And it's amazing the population. And, you know, I still try and follow it through Mike Yard or you or
right.
whoever's doing that work now. And it's remarkable the blow up of population of
right.
chub in the in the western end.
Right.
And they're obviously,
everywhere.
I don't think we've got a grasp as to what their spawning routine is
no.
down there.
No.
But we're picking up larval fish down there.
Yeah. Yeah, and full grown
and lots of full
all
grown.
The way
yeah.
down.
Lots of full
all
grown.
All the way down.
And yeah. you can really see that even off the back of the boat. Like
yeah.
I was at the helipad the other day, and there was just nothing but humpback chub swimming
yeah.
around the back of the boat.
Yeah.
And so it's nice to see these natives, you know, adapt.
Making a comeback.
Making
yeah.
a comeback. And it's hard to say whether it's, the river's obviously warmer now with the lower reservoir.
Right.
And I just wonder if that doesn't have a major role in the
yeah.
success down there.
Yeah, well, a lot of the biologists that are on our trip think it's more to the water temperature rather than the fish adapting. They think that the water is just, they don't think the fish are really adapting yet, but the water
the
is getting.
The environment has come more in their direction than they've
exactly.
been able to morph into a colder
right.
water fish and
right.
stuff. Yeah,
right.
That's interesting stuff. And so are you planning on doing those trips for a while longer?
I hope so.
Yeah, there you go. People ask me the same
yeah,
question.
Yeah,
are you still going to be down there?
Yeah, as long as my body
holds
up.
As long as
up.
We don't know, yeah. we don't know.
No, that's right. As long as the old body holds up, I keep going.
Yeah,
I love doing it.
Yeah, no, and that, you're meant to do it. You're meant for it. But do you feel like the river's doing okay? How are your feelings as far as in the time you've been there? What are you seeing as far as the river environment down there, other than the
yeah, the beaches
depleting
going away.
Sand?
Right,
that's
the only bad thing.
You know,
I was,
I've really noticed the vegetation increase.
Yes.
You know, down to the river. It used
yeah.
to be, oh, you had to have pretty high water for it to be into the vegetation.
Right.
And now it's way down there.
Right. The vegetation's taken away a lot of the camps, even. I mean, it's making it hard to get in there and camp because the vegetation has just taken over a lot.
Yeah.
But it's nice. It was not that it was nice, but during COVID when the river was closed for 2.5 months and we were the second trip, the Razorback Sucker was the second. There was one Canyoneer's boat ahead of me. When they reopened, we went out that day.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, which was nice because the river had had 2.5 months of nothing because it was closed. And so that was a different type of looking at things. Beaches were pristine just because they hadn't been used in 2.5 months, which I don't know if there's ever been a time when it's been closed for 2.5 months. Do you know?
No, I'd say that it was a very unique, especially during the main river season like that.
Right.
And I was down not too long after that.
Yeah.
And it really was remarkable. You saw this pristineness about the place. And
which
we don't
different.
Think that the human impacts are that many, but even just footprints on the beach are a little bit of an impact.
Yeah to, see, yeah, to see that people had been camping there, and once they hadn't been there, when the river was closed from April, May, and half of June, and then we went out in June to see those beaches, it was totally different.
Truth tell, all of it. What do you think as far as the environmental scene down there overall is one thing, but how about the rest of the world? You know, it just seems like there's a lot of impacts on our world. Do we have hope for saving some of it?
I hope so. I hope, you know.
What's your take?
I hope so. I hope people are paying attention. And I think the studies, they need to do the studies, because without the studies, you're going to go by the point of no return. So hopefully people pay attention and see what's going on. And I think they do once, you know, people that go down the canyon see the difference that they can make. I think it's an eye-opening experience for a lot of people, and to see what something should look like, because we pick it up and try to take care of some of our resources. So hopefully it opens eyes up to what we have and what we could lose. So...
And that transpires to the rest of the world, really, doesn't it? It's kind
totally.
Of like a laboratory experiment down there in the first place,
because
it's so controlled as far as the impacts and the visitation.
But, I haven't been around the world very much, but I imagine every place has its secret places, just like the Grand Canyon is secret. But I'm sure there are a lot of other beautiful places around that need to be taken care of or have somebody look at them, or we're going to lose them.
Well, and with that, thank you for your time. It's great to have you here.
You.
I'm really looking forward to our next river trip together.
Yeah.
One of these days, it's going to happen.
It's going to happen.
And it's Big Adventures with Carolyn Alvord and Brian Durker. And if you guys have sat through this, I'm sure you've learned as much as I have. I've always been fascinated with particularly the horse end of things here, and that was pretty good stuff. Thank you for being here, Carolyn.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, you guys, this is Big Adventures with Carolyn Alvord and Brian Durker, signing out.
Big Adventures is produced by Brian Durker, Margaret Knight, and me, Gavin Bugner. Bill Gleckler and his mandolin provide our music. If you like our show, please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.